Welcome to the Passion for Crass podcast. No.
Do it. I didn't. How did you just do it? That was great.
Welcome to Passion for Crass podcast. I'm Jackson Hall.
Are you enunciating your words at all? Go for it.
You start.
Welcome back to the Passion for Crass podcast.
Look at you.
I said podcast. I don't know. My name's Jackson. This is my dad, Brent. Apprentice, master, apprentice. We're going to talk about Windows on this one. One of the podcasts we look to for inspiration is the Acquired Podcast. It's a really good podcast on businesses. We have a desire to do a really long form podcast episode, maybe like 3 hours as one episode, maybe broken up into chunks, but we're trying to figure that out. This was an idea. We were going to maybe do even a longer form version of Windows as a long form one, right?
Yeah. So,
but we're going to do this first, shortened, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is a test. This is a test of the local broadcasting system. This is a test. This is only a test. Did you guys ever hear that growing up?
No.
Okay. So
I've seen it in movies.
Yeah, I've seen it in movies. Like we used to have.
You heard
like,
that?
On the radio. Yeah. This is only a test.
Yeah. Beep. Yeah. The long beeps.
And you'd be like, I mean, that happened, you know, all the time 30 years ago.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
And then we get one text in Hawaii about a missile on the way. And this was just a test.
Yeah.
Remember that?
As we look to try to make this a valuable podcast, the acquired things have been interesting because we listened to the one on Hermes, and it's all about craftsmanship and how they do that. And I sent it to all my people saying, hey, this is kind of the aspiration I have for Hull, that we're about craftsmanship. And so, but those long form podcasts where you really break down things, I said, you know, that'd be interesting to do for our podcast, especially something like Windows or like drywall, or like looking at the window thing. This is kind of a, do you guys like this format? We could carry it further.
And it's also a test, like, can we go the distance on 3 hours? I mean, obviously we would take breaks in the recording of it to like figure out, oh my gosh, I'm falling asleep over here. He's boring me, whatever. We're just trying to figure out like, do informationally, do we have the distance to kind of go?
Well, and the acquired thing is a business podcast.
Yeah.
So they break down the financials of those companies that we're not going to do. That's not really in our...
I don't even know how they do that. Do you know how they do that?
I think they go through like board reports, because those are a lot of public companies. And so you can look at annual reviews and dividends and
stuff.
It's
crazy that they're like, they know the stuff they know. Anyway, sorry. Side note. It's a good podcast. Check it out.
So this is one on Windows, and if our, in America, our realm of understanding for Windows is from 1750, let's say, to 19 to today, you're really looking at a number of distinct periods, and probably the first period would be a first period window would be from the, let's just say, 1750s into the 1850s. Probably, maybe 1880s, okay? And a lot of that is driven by glass, okay? And the technology and availability of glass. I think that's where we have to start.
Okay.
Because then you go from post-industrial revolution, let's just say 1880, into 1940, because 1940, 1950, you get into the glass changes to plate glass. And so the window sizes grow quite a bit after that.
Let's define a little bit of terms. Plate glass.
Okay, well, we'll talk about glass, but let me just stay big picture.
Yeah.
So we got glass that drives window technology a long time. You have to talk about that. But then you have to talk about what today is kind of a post-1900 world view, where you're looking at the how did Marvin, how did Pella, how did, you know, Anderson, where did those window companies come from? How did they start, right? And so one of these, you know, the test of this thing could just be like Marvin Windows. Let's talk about Marvin Windows, where they are, what they're building today, and how it matters and how it affects things. And so if we're thinking about windows in the built environment, the majority of the windows I see on new houses are casement windows. Mm. And casement windows, I've explained to people, was never really an American style of window. The English, basically with the Hampton Court Palace, Sir Christopher Wren, okay, basically, if you look at the backside of that building, they are double hungs. And the British model was to have a double hung window, a sash that moves up and down in a track, as opposed to the French model, which was a casement, okay? And so you look at French windows and French houses, and they are casement windows. And you look at English and American houses, and they're double hungs.
Casement meaning they swing out.
Yes. They are on a hinge. They're made like a door. Okay, and they'll be in swing or out swing. And so today you're looking at a lot of casement windows, but that's not really a popular traditional American style of window.
The other type of window is the one that pops in, swings in.
So you have the awning and the basement windows that pop in or pop up or pop out. Yeah. So I don't know why so many people are using casement windows today. I'd have to do the pricing to see if they're cheaper. Mm-hmm. It would make sense to me that they're cheaper. That's why they're doing it that way.
Because they're not using weights on the inside of them.
They're not using the pulleys and balances and things that are a part of that. I suspect they're easier and quicker to build because you're not building. You're putting two windows in two different tracks on a double hung, whereas one you're just sticking one in a frame and able to run it out the door. So. Right. I suspect it's cheaper. You have cladding that a lot of people do. You have wood quality. You have the general perception of windows and just how long they last and everything else. And so why did we do our 100-year window? Why did we start doing that? And what's happened to windows? So a lot of this discussion is we consider whether this deep dive is worth it. It's just there's a type of window that we're putting in our house today. Mm-hmm. Why are we doing that? What is the expectation for quality and life expectancy of a window today.
Yeah.
And then, of course, because of my brain and because of what we studied, we're looking back through history and going, well, what's the precedent? What's the right answer? What should we be putting into our houses? Mm-hmm. Not only stylistically, but what windows should look like and how did that window pattern form? Right. So, right. And so I say all those things and I go, that kind of sounds pretty boring. And so, maybe that's not something we spend time on. But anyway, the window world is vast, okay? To spend 5 minutes on technology, realize that windows were up until probably the 1800s, even into the Leavitt period, window sash were oftentimes made separate from the window glass, okay? Yeah. And so, one of the things that Leavitt did when he started building his houses in the 40s is he was bringing out windows pre-glazed into the house, okay? Because before then, you would order a window, and oftentimes in some markets, they would bring the glass, a separate glazing union or glazing group would come out and glaze your windows. And so
they had the glass and the sash on site, and then they would
the wood sash would show up, okay?
Yeah.
You would, install the windows, and then a glazier would come along and put glass in. And so as opposed to sending the window out from the factory with glass.
Yeah. I was just going to say, quick logistical question. How do you want to work our way through this? Because we're kind of in Leavitt Town right now. Do you want
to... Well, I jumped ahead to say that's when that change happened. Okay. That it became common after that time to have window glass come from the manufacturers.
Cool.
But if you think that in 1940, there were still windows being made that showed up on the job site unglazed, it's kind of crazy. Crittle Windows, which is a steel window manufacturer, you buy their windows, it comes with no glass. So... There are some old school manufacturers that still make windows that way, that they quote you a window price that does not include glass. So
if you're getting a window with no glass, do you then have to cut the glass yourself or I guess hire someone to cut it and then?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what glazers did. And so glazer unions did and they would have done all that. So, So anyway, glass was technologically a big thing. Why? Because glass, if you look at Wren's building, the back of Wren's building, you'll see in those individual panes of glass, these gray sheets. Okay. Yeah. And that glass, you might fire it. You're melting sand. You're putting potash. You're putting some other things in that mixture so that when you put it into a cylinder and blow it into a sheet of glass, it doesn't discolor, okay? Mm. And I was looking, so there's the back of Hampton Court Palace. Those were the double-hung windows that became so defining. But zooming in on that, you'll see some of those pieces actually are discolored, okay?
Is that across the pond?
Yes, that is in the UK.
When was this built?
Early 1700s.
Okay.
Maybe late 1600s.
So they're still throwing glass and everything.
Yeah, it would probably been like 1720, 1740.
Yeah.
Something like that. And so all glass, yeah, so there you see the those individual the pieces that are discolored. And that happened after it was exposed to UV light. So it, in the factory, they didn't look like it, but some of it discolored. You'll see colors with yellows and purples at the Staub house. They're looking out of the bay window there. You'll see yellows and purples. Why did Staub in 1928 put yellow and purple glass in his windows? It was because it was natural for those some of those glasses to discolor over time. You see it there. Part of the science of making glass clear was not real easy. And so the French
was not known. Okay.
And so the French were probably the best glass makers. And then the English learned it from the French. And there wasn't a glass manufacturer, I should say, there wasn't a big glass manufacturer in the United States until around 1880, 1890, okay?
Holy smokes.
And so you sit there and go, what? Because I've got millwork catalogs from the 1890s that say British glass, still selling British and French glass in an American market in the 1880s.
Okay, to put that in perspective for anyone out there who doesn't know glass, and I still think we got to back up and we got to talk about first window and other stuff like that. But to put that in perspective, in order to get glass, you had to take a plate of glass, cut it up, a sheet of glass, cut it up into whatever sizes you needed for whatever job, package them, put them on a ship, and then have that ship sail. Not, I mean, we're not talking cruise liners with some slight rocking. Like, it's getting rocked back and forth and thrown everywhere. Like, glass broke commonly on these trips. And then it's delivered to you months later to where you can then put it in. Like, how long is that journey?
Well, they was common enough that it would have been stocked. And so you would have had manufacturers, you know,
you'd have
Asians in the United States who were reselling.
But you see what I'm saying? Like, getting glass, like for those, let's say those people who are buying the glass, who are like prepping the glass for, to go, I'm a glass seller. No,
it's kind of shocking, right?
And it's so much money to get that glass over.
And so the anyway. and it speaks to how labor intensive and how capital intensive starting a glass company was in the 18th and 19th century.
Yeah.
And so and even, you know, early 20th century. And so it was incredibly expensive, incredibly capital intensive to do that. So
Pittsburgh
Plate Glass Company, right? Yeah. PPG, they were one of the early innovators to start making glass in America.
Whenever I look at any old house now, I'm just thinking of like that piece of glass on a ship rocking back and forth, crate sliding around, made it through. You know what I mean? Like, that's just staggering.
When I was doing research for my book, there was a company in Boston that was making glass a little bit, but there was no national manufacturer of glass. And the importance of glass is also said in the way windows were even ordered in the 1700s and 1800s, where you would say, you know, a 6-light, 6x9 window.
Yeah.
But what are you saying? Okay, I'm talking about, I need a 6-light, so 6-light sash. Each sash is a 6x9 frame. You didn't say, I need a 32x64 window. You described the sash that you were ordering to order the window.
Yeah.
The frame of that window was kind of standardized.
Yeah.
And you were ordering it by the glass size, because what that allowed them to do was make the sheets, cut them by 6x9 so that those things could be packed as tight as possible so they wouldn't break.
Right.
But you would have a standard size 6x9, 8x10 window that would end up at your job.
Yeah. The other thing with glass that's something to consider is, and I don't want to jump ahead of you, I'm going to talk about how they spin them and how they cut them. When they spin the glass, basically you've got a circular sheet of glass that you end up with. So if you think about, and with, I don't know how big were they?
About 3 feet. About crown or table glass. So there we crown go. Glass.
That's a great image right there. So basically, if you're talking 6x9, that takes up a portion of that 3 foot glass.
Right.
And you're left with these little extras that you can't really use. But so you only have a finite amount of glass with each blow.
Correct.
And each blow is like, you blow it, you spin it, you cut it, you lay it out. Okay, next one. Blow it, spin it, cut it, lay it out. So
that's why, one reason why divided light windows, okay, are so popular in that period of time because, well, they couldn't get big sheets of glass.
Couldn't and
the
do
reason,
big sheets.
The reason why in the ranch period you have huge, big sheets of glass, it was the first time that they were able to make sheets that big.
Technology.
And so technology was driving that. And you wonder why you see the little diamond-paned little pictures on old leaded glass windows. It's because that was a standard size they could get out of a sheet of a crown or table glass. And
honestly, those are the cheaper ones.
Right.
Like those little ones are the cheaper ones because they're often offcuts of someone buying a big guy.
So after the crown and table glass, where they would basically take a molten piece of glass, a bulb with the blow puntle.
They have a big pipe, and a long pipe.
A puntle.
Yeah. And I know, I'm just describing it.
And they would blow through that. They would pop the balloon that would come out, and they'd start spinning. They would create this big disc.
Yeah, there's an
And
image.
Then you in the middle, you would have what becomes the bullseye glass that you sometimes see over doors, the transom or the bullseye right there in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
That might be, it was a waste product. It was basically, and that's why they ended up as transoms over doors, because there's a waste piece. But then you go to cylinder glass. And so cylinder glass was, and then you see this guy standing on a platform, but
your sentence just there. And then cylinder glass, and you see this guy standing on the platform, just minus the sneeze. That's what you just said.
Cylinder glass was basically made into a cylinder. So instead of being a circular disc, there's now a cylinder.
How did they draw it out like that?
That it was by weight and by gravity. And so he would stand up on a platform like you see in this picture, and he would drop, he would get that cylinder hot, and then he would drop it, and he would actually swing that his pipe down, and it would stretch the glass. It would actually stretch the glass.
Help me understand this. I'm looking at this image. And it looks like he is standing like this. Like he's standing up and he's blowing that way. He's going to swing that down?
Yes.
So is that a trough underneath him that it's going to swing into? Okay.
Yeah. So he's up on a platform. He's got a trough in between him.
Yeah.
And he's got that little brace he's got there, you know, supports that heavy piece of glass as it's back in the furnace heating up. And then he swings it down. The weight of that glass just kind of drops the glass.
Keeps drooping.
And then
is he blowing while it's drooping?
Yeah, but at the point he doesn't have to anymore
because gravity just kind of takes hold.
And then he'll take those, and then they made them into, you know, let's say 8 foot long little tubes that they would then cut off the top, cut it down the middle. It would lay out flat, and then you'd have this sheets of glass, much bigger sheets of glass.
Yeah.
Okay, and so glass became less expensive for bigger sheets.
Right.
Then by about the turn of the century, they did that same thing with machines. And that machine would go down there, you know, blow into a tube, lift it up in the air, and then make these bigger pieces of glass these guys would then cut, lay out. Now, that's why up and through the World War II, you have windows with glass that is wavy because it was made in the cylinder method. And then later they had the float glass, which is right after World War II. There was no imperfections in that glass, and you can make much bigger sheets.
Is that because they like press it?
No, because it comes out off a conveyor line.
Okay.
And the glass is actually cooling on a sheet of molten tin. The glass floats on the tin, it dries and cools, and there's just no imperfections.
They press out the imperfections, kind of with that big thing that comes down over top?
I don't think so.
Okay. It's just the heat of the tin.
Yeah, the way it's laid out. I think it is rolled when it's coming through there, but it's...
So that it doesn't... It'll roll out any imperfections.
Completely flat.
Yeah, look at that, man.
So
wow.
So now glass is big flat sheets, right? And see how big that sheet is? I mean, it's you know, huge, but the technology enabled them to do that. So
they've got a pane that's broken right there. They should just fix it. They've got glass.
In their factory?
Yeah, in their factory.
Yeah. Cobbler's son wears no shoes.
Yeah, exactly.
Glass is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Driving that technology. The other thing that happens, early pieces of glass is that early sash is that they're thin. They're like 1 inch thick. And so thin glass, thin sash, you don't really have the 1 3/8, 1 3/4 glass or 2 1/4 inch sash until you get into the industrial period where, and even double hung windows aren't counterbalanced and counterweighted commonly until probably the 1850s into the 1880s.
So they're hard to open.
And the top sash is fixed, okay? That doesn't move. and the bottom sash might have a track and it might have pegs or a stick to hold it open.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
when we're talking sash,
right?
What are you talking about?
The actual moving parts in the window, the upper sash, lower sash that are moving up and down.
And then the bars in the middle are called?
Muntins.
Okay. Just trying to get all the, trying to stay a big picture.
As we move into, let's say, the 1900s, once you understand the technology and the stuff that goes into that, and then you move maybe into the Victorian period, when you move away from the simple 6/6 sash or 2/2.
And then just right before that, let's talk about the caming windows. Originally, those really small, like checkered patterns that you saw, it's called caming. What you would do is you would take lead and you would form it around these windows. That's the caming process, right?
Well, the lead caming is the molded lead that is kind of a U-channel that is folded over the glass. And then
and that was pre-glazing.
When you say pre-glazing.
They didn't have like window glaze that they put on, right?
Well, glazing is the glass.
Hmm. Misunderstood something. What is the stuff that you put in?
Putty. The putty.
The putty. Okay, yeah. That's what I thought was glazing.
Yeah.
That's embarrassing.
No. I mean, I think they're kind of used interchangeably depending on the context, depending on the period, depending on when it was done. And so
that was pre putty in the window.
No, you always had putty glazing, right?
Okay.
Putty holding the glass in. Okay?
Even in the lead caming days? I thought there wasn't any then.
No, there
was. I thought it just fit in the channel and then they just bent it around.
No, there's still like those windows are waterproofed and weatherproofed with putty.
Hmm.
And so you don't necessarily see it.
Yeah.
But I've watched them glaze windows and they'll take a little piece of putty and they're just rubbing it back and forth across the glass in different directions. Yeah. And that putty is going into that channel that's holding the lead channel, and it's kind
of
keeps the water out. It makes them weatherproof.
Okay, so that's the first style of window, right? Was there anything before that? In America, at least, that's the first style of window.
Yeah, I mean, you have like early windows like you see at the Paul Revere House. Those are lead. They're leaded glass windows,
right? They're casement leaded glass windows.
Right.
Yeah. And then wood got involved in the picture after.
Yeah, so when
The Muntins.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's an historian out there that could say the first house in America to have wood sash, and I don't know what that is.
That's part of the research. Like, if we were doing the 3-hour one, we would have that for everyone context.
But
there was a first wood window, but when did that start becoming the standard?
I would say during the Georgian period.
Really?
Yeah, because the Paul Revere House is a first period house. It's a colonial house, and that's why you've got. It looks like a little English cottage, right? Because you've got casement windows, you've got leaded glass.
Look at the chimney location.
Very interesting.
So that's what I would say was first period, and then Georgian, they were central.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
you got a plank door, you got leaded glass windows, right? This is a first period colonial house.
That's right.
And so when you get into, do you know what the date is in the Paul Revere House?
1660,
yeah.
I want to say.
Okay.
I think the oldest building in America through Dendro has been stated as 1642 or something. And so.
One's still standing. In any case, I was going to say that's pre-1700. So if you think about, I usually categorize the Georgian period of architecture starting in America around 1740.
Yeah.
And so that pre that time are colonial houses.
Mm-hmm.
That aren't, you know, style specific. They're you know.
They describe them to us as first period.
Yeah.
Corbelled chimneys was like one of the ways you could tell that it was
first period. What is a corbelled chimney?
It's like where the chimney has like the, like the.
He says on a podcast, perfectly understand it now.
Audio listeners, you know that's what I'm talking about. It looks like the upside down staircase. That is, so you've got the like shaft of the chimney. And then it's like an upside down staircase walking out from the chimney, and then it kind of walks back in. So it kind of has this
like a fat thing in the middle.
Yeah, almost. It's right there.
Where do you see that?
It's right there. See how it's corbelled?
Oh, you're right at the top.
Yeah, right at the top.
Oh, the decorative corbelling at the top. Okay.
That's right.
Yeah, because the lower brick corbels is supporting the upper brick, right?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. They just called it corbelling, and they said it's categorized categorized as first period homes.
Okay, there you go.
The other thing that's categorizing them is that step off that they do.
Right.
Because
it's called a jerkin head or something, I think.
That's right. It's
or is that right?
Jerkin step or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So the first period house, right. And so if you're tracking when the double hung becomes popular, it's in the Georgian period, 1740, 1780. Most houses after that period that are of any significance have a wood sash double hung window.
Okay.
So
double hung.
Yeah.
Does double hung always mean they both move?
No.
Okay.
No. It's the configuration
of
a top and a bottom sash.
What is single hung then?
Plain. Yeah, no. Single hung is when you get into the, like, say, 1910, most windows by that time are counterbalanced. Okay.
Yeah.
And to order a window single hung is actually a cheaper way of ordering it so that they don't have the weights and pulleys. The top window would be fixed. And so it's single hung.
Yeah.
So because I would think that a standard in 1900 is that you order a double hung window, both sash are operating.
Yeah.
And if you ordered it single hung, you're saying, I don't want that top sash to move. Yeah.
So would these first period ones that didn't have the top sash moving, would they be single hung or would they still be double hung?
Technically single hung.
Okay.
Yeah.
By today's standards.
Actually, they're not hung. Okay. They're not hung with weights and pulleys. They are a.
Oh, yeah. It's just a sliding operating.
Right. It's just a sliding. It's an operating sash.
It's a casement window. No, it's not a casement window. It's a sash. What is it? It's casement. And what's the other type?
It's a double hung configuration.
Okay.
Okay. But neither sash are, if you wanted to get technical, neither sash are hung.
Right.
Okay. With weights and pulleys. And because that's essentially what you're doing, you're hanging the window in the pocket with the weights. And so neither sash is hung, but it is an operable lower sash.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool.
Where windows start to change into the Victorian period when you have a Queen Anne sash.
Mm.
And the Queen Anne sash is a decorative sash on the top and a single light sash on the bottom.
Yeah.
And so you have these windows that have etched glass, that have all these crazy features in them sometimes.
Goodness. Yeah.
That are very decorative, right? And this is a time when the windows become, they're showing off the technology, showing off the manufacturability and getting some pretty crazy window styles.
So speaking of history a little bit, talk to me about some of this stuff, because when were the dates again on plate windows? And like, when were the dates on—
Okay, so plate glass, okay, if you look at it historically, was being made in the early industrial period. So I think plate glass, you begin to see it made in the 1850s, 1860s in Europe.
Okay.
And basically they are taking a piece of cylinder glass or they're taking molten glass and they are putting it in a big sheet and grinding it, into flatness.
Hmm.
Okay, so they're taking their pumices and their steels and things like that. So they're laying out the piece of plate glass, and then you see them rolling it into a flat sheet, and then they would grind it smooth, and the grinding would be they'd take this pumice stone and these other buffers, and they literally have these big machines that are just going, and they're grinding and smoothing that surface out till it's a big sheet of glass. And so
is that fine enough of a material to where it's not going to leave behind scratches and stuff?
You don't see any scratches the way it's buffed out. And that's an industrial process that would have been. So by the 1880s, 1890s, you'll see these huge wheels that are turning. They're taking that glass and making it flat. And that's why you have storefronts in that late 1800s, early 1900s, big pieces of glass, mm-hmm. right, which wouldn't have been cylinder. They were plate glass, and they were big plates of glass. And so that's where plate glass comes from.
Hmm. So I guess I'm looking at those Queen Anne ones. So those were all cylinder.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. As I remember, there are ways that you could have had in those old books plate glass for your windows. Okay. But it was like asking for the best glass possible to be put into your window. So there's no movement,
no imperfections.
And so very wealthy people might ask for plate glass in their sash as a show of, wealth.
You said it was as early as the 1860s in England, so they would still be shipping it over if that was the case?
Yes.
Well, that is crazy.
As you move into the other thing that we need to remember, that as we move into the 1900s, let's just say 1900, every lumber yard in America, that's an exaggeration, most good lumber yards in America would have had a sash department, would have had a team that could make sash. And I know that there are still lumber yards today that will make sash.
Does sash include the muttons?
Yes.
Okay.
So that will make divided light sash, okay? They're old school now. They would be considered very old school. But most good lumber yards, and I'm speaking particularly in the Northeast, would have, you could order a sash. If you had a sash break, hey, will you give me a 6/6? Yeah. And because all those parts and pieces were standardized, you could get, you know, new sash made for your house.
What do you mean by standardized? The glass was standardized or the wood was standardized?
The parts, the 2-inch style, 2-inch rail, you know, check rail, all those different things that are part of the kind of a standard window.
Sorry, I'm looking over at your window. Yeah. What do you guys use? Like, what are the dimensions on your window? Do you use 2-inch?
Yeah, so it's a 2-inch style, you know, maybe 2 1/4 when you consider the shoulder and the profile.
Right.
And then 1 1/4 check rail and 3-inch bottom sash. So,
what are the muttons?
3/4. They could get as small as 7/8, biggest 7/8, as small as 5/8. In any case, the worlds of the Marvins and the Pellas and Andersons grow out of that environment. Okay. Yeah. They grow out of an environment when most lumber yards were making sash.
And
right?
It was standardized.
And it was standardized going back to the 1870s, probably 1880s. When you'd have standard sizes and details and stuff like that. Marvin, basically, it was a lumber and cedar company, right? Mm-hmm. They were up in Warroad, Minnesota, which
cedar, not lumber.
Yeah, but they were doing like cedar ash. They had a special use for cedar that they were doing.
Okay.
And so this Warroad, Minnesota, is a really small town in northern Minnesota, and so it's not a huge city at all. In fact,
looks mad.
One of the biggest challenges that Marvin has is finding people who can work there because I don't know how big Warroad, maybe it's 20,000 people, 30,000 people.
At the time, or currently?
Currently. And Marvin employs like 50,000 people, right? And so they've got people coming from all over that region coming to work for them. So
I never realized Marvin was in such a small town. That's kind of hilarious.
Yeah, a really small town. Well, they started in the early 1900s. And, you know, one of the reasons they started making sash was to keep the guys busy during winter hours.
Mm.
So they're a lumber company, right?
Yeah.
So that wasn't atypical of lumber companies making sash, kind of, you know, making time while winter is going on. In any case, that's the environment they come up in. So Anderson was a frame company. They made frames. In fact, I've got ads in my library of Anderson silent type frames, Anderson solid white pine frames. And why would they do that? Why would Anderson grow up as a frame company? Because so many lumber yards could make sash, they were making the frame. Okay. And so it's just interesting seeing how all those parts and pieces would be put together and realizing some of those markets they were doing that, those people who were making the sash weren't even glazing them. So you had a number of different parties and you know, people putting the frame together, putting the sash together and glazing the window.
That monopoly oriented, the reason they wouldn't just do it all? Or is that
union, right? You had a glazing union that was.
I have a bit of an embarrassing question. How does a union work?
That is episode.
and if you don't know either, that's okay.
How does union work? Like unions start because they're very similar to guilds, right? That guilds would be, they would want to hold on to and manage the dissemination of material and the dissemination of labor, the dissemination of work in a community.
I feel like guilds are more like information that they're holding on to, less. Maybe information and labor, not necessarily the materials. Is the materials a big part of it?
Well, I mean, just like if you look at the early guilds, like let's just say a builder's guild.
Yeah,
they're not really necessarily managing material, but how to manufacture and make the raw material into something usable.
Yeah,
right. They wouldn't control the lumber market, but they would certainly control how you turn lumber into a house. So, but basically, the real union era in America happens during the late 1800s, early 1900s, when the robber barons, when the when the steel magnates, the railroad magnates, the other people are
Rockefeller.
Yeah, they're building those industries up, and they are abusive. Yeah. Okay. Of their labor, right? Yeah. And you think of the child labor laws and the things that had to be put in place because manufacturers were killing people, right? And and abusing labor, making people work too long. So
great prices.
The labor, the labor got together and says, this is unfair.
They can't treat us like
let's
this.
Strike, right? And so let's stop working so that they have to pay us more, or they have to give us only 8 hours in a day, or whatever the thing is. And so the unions basically are trying to force fair habits. Now, the problem with unions, and you think about, you know, the Chevrolets and the auto workers, right? In the 50s, at the height of the automobile industry, the unions were striking for and getting benefits that ultimately bankrupt a General Motors or a Ford or whatever else, because they basically negotiated this contract at the very peak of quality and everything else, that by the time you get to the 70s, by the time you get to the oil embargoes and the gas rationing and everything else, the world of making automobiles in the 70s is very different from the 50s when they organized these things. The benefits they struck for, right, that you have to pay us this amount of money, and when we retire at 55, we get these benefits going, was not affordable by the 70s. And so that pendulum of fairness, one, it was unfair to the workers. Now it's unfair to, cost and efficiency and everything else. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, that's another whole nother episode, I suppose.
Sorry, yeah. I was just curious.
Yeah, it's trying to, I would just say unions are an effort from labor to try to organize.
Keep things fair.
Yeah, and keep things fair.
A little check and balance.
So
all these window unions start up.
So part of the reason why of all those disparate groups doing
this. This guy's the frame.
That,
this guy's right, the glass.
This guy's the carpenter's union. This guy's the glazier's union. This guy's, and they are holding on to, carpenter's union can't take the glazier's union's work.
Hmm.
So glazier's union has to do the windows. Sash have to come to the job site with no glass in it, because the glazier's union have power over that area. And that's why it's not something that happened all over the country. It happened in pockets. Mm-hmm. And so New York, I think, probably is the last kind of stronghold of those of holding on to some of those requirements in building and everything else. That certain people, like, we'll do trade shows in Philadelphia, and you can't move stuff off your truck onto the floor, because that's the union's job is.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, there's strict rules about
stuff
like that.
Someone was telling me about that, and I was kind of like, I don't know. I'm just not, like, it's not a huge union culture around here.
It's not. It's a ride to work state. So
And so there's always very funny, like, I hear some of these stories, like Ryan's telling us about the time in the union. He's like, there are guys whose job it is to move material around. And then there's guys whose job it is to do whatever. And some guys will just, like, kind of grab, like, I guess he was saying when he first got there, he would grab something and they'd be like, no, that's not your job. And it's kind of like a weird mentality shift where you got to go, nope, not my job. And I don't know. I should just help out. I should just
Brent
get
Holt bias is that it's an unfortunate place right now.
Right.
I'm fine with whatever they can negotiate for themselves and everything else, but I'm not sure it's the most efficient way to be building today.
Right. So it just seems somewhat slow, where you just be like, well,
you understand the spirit of it,
why they
did that originally. But
it's a great idea.
Yeah.
Right.
But now it's
people,
like,
it helps. Yeah.
Really? Are we still doing this?
Yeah.
For those big union guys who listen, I'm sorry if we're blowing holes in your product. So anyway, if we look at our world, the Pellas, Anderson, Colby's, Pella is from Iowa. They were a roller blind company to start. They were a rolling screen product away from that was basically retractable into the wall. Is what I understood, that's how they got their start.
They're like, now we got to build.
Yeah, now we got to build the window because they don't,
attach to our blind.
Yeah,
or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we've got to, provide the accessory window because, our roller blinds don't work on everybody. So let's build our own window. They all kind of grow from the 19, Anderson's the oldest, was making frames in 1915, 1920. I think Marvin doesn't really start making windows until the 1930s or 40s. Pella was the same way, 20s and 30s. And so the bigger picture on the window as itself is that realize that every window before 1940 was basically a wood window, because the wood sash, wood frame, wood everything. There were some steel windows on the market. After World War II, you have the aluminum market.
Totally. Okay.
So after our house, 1962, has steel, has wood, and has aluminum. Now, the aluminum are the cheap windows on the side, but they are part of that ranch tradition. You know, the wood window was the cheapest window you could put in. It was also very nice and everything else. It kind of spanned that whole product line. After, when you get into the 1950s, after the World War II, this strong desire to be as cheap and quick as possible leads to the aluminum window market and the aluminum window in general that, you know, are pretty cheap windows. Yeah. So now you're going into a period of time where a wood window is a premium, okay? And so then you get into fiberglass, then you get into vinyl and all those different materials that 70s, 80s, 90s become real popular. Hmm. Okay, and the wood window all of a sudden is now a premium, okay? And a wood window is like the top of the market.
Did the cost switch up that much?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just because they had so many metal factories and other like factories from the war, then all those materials were easier, it's cheaper, faster to work with.
Yeah. And so cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. I mean, cost was the thing that was really driving those numbers and driving that world. And so, ironically, when I start in business, the wood window is the premium window, right? Mm-hmm. Is the most expensive window.
Yeah.
Which you see cladding and metal cladding in the early 1900s. Yeah. But because we're out of the era of old growth wood after 1940, really, the wood windows that are the premium wood windows are made of cheap wood. Mm-hmm. So one of my complaints against the Marvins and Pellas and production windows. One of my problems with them is that they are still using finger jointed radiata pine, which is a terrible wood in most markets in this country. And the reason why we started making our 100-year window with good wood is because we can no longer rely on a true wood window to last very long, right?
To be a true wood window, not a glue window.
And then the third piece that changed windows and window design is insulated glass. Mm-hmm. And what happened with is,
window
is
makes
in, a difference. In insulated glass.
Yeah.
And you know, the energy efficiency of single pane, the energy efficiency of an insulated piece of glass and how that changed the look of a window and everything else. So, you know, now today we are wrestling with, you know, how to get a good window in your house.
Yeah.
Right. What do you do? Historically, if you look at it, you would say a wood window is the premium, the best window you can put into it. Energy efficiency wise, you know, Steve and Matt and Jake and those guys in the Build Show, they're using a European triple glaze window, very expensive window that is made by European companies, but there's no divided lights on those windows. Right. There's nothing.
Is there even the fake divided lights?
Not that I know of. They are chasing after efficiency model, right? Yeah. And so it works well on a modern house. It doesn't work very well on a traditional house. And so what does a guy who wants to build a good traditional house have to do today to get a good window? And so that's where we argue for our window. We say, look, our window is a 100-year window because the wood quality is really good. The glass isn't going to fail. And, you know, we think you can manipulate your envelope of your house with insulation, with other things to get it prescriptive, right, as opposed to a programmatic. It's a prescription that you're writing that let's get your walls to this, let's put these things in here, but let's put a single pane window and give you the beauty, give you the tradition, give you the long lasting sustainability, but you know, the energy efficiency is the compromise. But with storms, with interior storms, with, you know, other things, we can get you to hit the U values. Now, I would also argue in Texas, California, Florida, most of the South, you don't need insulated glass.
Yeah.
There are other ways to manage that heat gain and other things like that without trying to play with the insulated glass.
Okay, this is like slight off topic, but it's very on topic. Do you think people have become less tolerant to colder and warmer weathers? like as of late, just you've been in the industry a long time. This idea of having your house as a bubble is really rather new in a lot of ways. And so I'm just thinking like, what in the world? Like, I just remember like working at a summer camp outdoors. Like there was a summer in like 2014, 15 when I was working there where all of a sudden they were, our camp director was like, we're getting so many complaints from parents that it's too hot at camp now for their kids. So we're adding air conditioning in every one of the barns. We're like, air conditioning? Who needs air conditioning? Like I grew up going to that camp my whole life and I never had air conditioning there.
You know, what we used to, if it got cold, you put a sweater on in your house. Yeah. Now you go do the dial on your thing and go 72.
Yeah.
You know, it was 71. I want it 72 and a little hotter.
Right.
And that we have become used to like cars.
Yeah.
Like I remember air conditioning cars was okay.
Yeah.
But most of the time it didn't work. And the idea of having air conditioning, you got air conditioning? Oh my gosh, this is great.
Really?
Oh my gosh. And so my mom had a BMW when I was in probably middle school and her complaint was the air conditioning was terrible. Mm. We realized just like the Germans don't know how to do good air conditioning for America because it's so hot here. And so her air conditioning was just a joke. And so she ended up getting rid of that car because she couldn't keep it cool. And so we used to drive around with car windows rolled down and you had your side window. It turned purposely so that it could direct air right on you so it wasn't so hot.
I know those
and
windows,
so there's no doubt that this technology has spoiled us and created an expectation that it has to be, you know, well, I'm cold. Well, turn it up 1 degree. And you're like, that isn't real.
1 degree.
Yeah.
And I know. And he said, I do it in my house. So you're like, oh, I'm hot. 1, 2. I'm like,
yeah. I mean, we're trained ourselves to be
ninnies. Yeah. Well, I guess the reason I bring it up is because going from Texas to Colorado to Boston.
You're in Boston.
Yeah. Thank you. Where? Doing that kind of jump around, I'm kind of like, how in the world is this? I don't know. It keeps blowing me away. I keep getting blown away every single time because they're not allowing fireplaces on new builds in Boston homes because it's going to let in too much cold air. And I'm looking at some of these old homes. And I'm like, these are drafty old homes. Like the idea of having a sealed house that's going to be whatever. Like the reality is the homes were probably 60 degrees on a warm day. You know what I mean? Like
the, I remember
warm winter day.
Well, I mean, if you look just demographically.
Yeah.
At the migration in America of where people live after 1950, after the period when air conditioning became available in houses is when the general southern migration began to happen, and you know most people move south now. If you look at the U-Haul maps of where people are moving, it's south. They're not moving north, and so
it's easier to cool.
That's
heat.
Only available right. I think that's only true because of that. So there's a general overarching thing. I can't imagine living in a 1950s house without air conditioning when windows don't open, right? And just and so.
Well, that was the other thing at Texas. At camp, whenever they added the air conditioning, the units kept freezing over because they were working so hard. And so what we had to do was we had to put plexiglass over every one of the screen windows so that it actually kept in the cool air so that they wouldn't start freezing over.
Yeah.
Anyway, but then when you do that, if you don't have the AC on, you're going to be miserable.
Yeah.
So you're creating a sauna it's a catch-22, right? Like it's because if you have the open house, open concept, everything, it breathes and it's nice and it's airy.
Well, then what we're creating, like I've said this before, but if we go to the zombie apocalypse when there's no electricity. We like our ranch house. We couldn't live in.
No,
we don't have any windows that open.
No,
it's just you. Okay, all of a sudden you're moving back to bungalows where you've got windows that open and close because otherwise you wouldn't survive. Because
the ranch giant windows makes a greenhouse effect in the day and
So anyway,
that's so interesting.
All right. Okay. So there's windows. There's the semi deep dive into windows. you guys will have to let us know whether you like that or not.
And I mean, we could talk a lot more quality of windows. We could talk about Pella Anderson, the reputation that they have nowadays. Talk about custom window shops. Percentage of the market that they own.
Right. We do a cost comparison.
We do a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So anyway, food for thought.
Yep.
Let us know how you thought this style went. We want to continue to grow and do better on these podcasts. And so, if there's a better way of doing it, we want to figure it out. Thanks for watching.